I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week are residential schools in the North. The network of Indian residential schools in Canada extended from coast to coast to coast, but it is the northern part of the country that has not gotten as much scholarly attention as the schools in the south of Canada. But the system did operate in the north, and it is the subject of a new book by Crystal Gale Fraser entitled By Strength, We Are Still Here, Indigenous Peoples and Indian Residential Schooling in Inuvik Northwest Territories. And as the overview says, this is the first comprehensive study of Indian residential schools in the north. And Crystal, in her study, uses oral history, interviews survivors from the schools in the north, while also drawing on the Gwich'in concepts of individual and collective strength. And in doing so, she discusses student experiences and highlights the many ways in which the students and Indigenous communities throughout the North resisted the institutionalization of their children and the system of residential schools. And the focus of the book really is the period from 1959 until 1982. And it's in 59 when the construction of Grolier and Stringer Halls was completed, massive residential schools in Inuvik. And that's really the focus of the book. And it really is a wonderful contribution to the literature, an area of study that has gotten more attention in Canada, the residential school system in general, but certainly the North has not been studied to the same extent. And this is an absolutely wonderful contribution and a much needed and welcome one as well. So I had the opportunity to speak with Crystal. If you remember last week's episode, I mentioned that my old mic died and I had to re-record my side of the conversation that I had with Stephen Osborne. It was during my conversation with Crystal that the microphone died. So the first half hour is on the old mic, and everything's fine with it. And then I re-recorded the last 15 minutes of my side of the conversation. So you might notice a bit of a change around the half hour mark on this episode. And that's me re-recording my side of the conversation. We are releasing this one now because the book is coming out on December the 13th, Friday, December the 13th. So held it for a week so that we could have it a little closer to that release date. So as you listen to this, if you're listening to it before the 13th, you can still get that pre-order copy. But on the 13th and afterwards, you can head over to the University of Manitoba Press and pick up your copy. So with all that preamble, let's get right into my chat with Crystal Gale Fraser. All right. And Crystal Gale Fraser joins me now. Crystal, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing really well. Very excited to talk about the book. As I said in the intro, By Strength, We Are Still Here, Indigenous Peoples and Indian Residential Schooling in Inuvik Northwest Territories. And I want to start with the scope of the book and what your background was in these stories. Because if you read the bio, you're from the region, you're from the North. So from your experience growing up, how familiar were you with these stories before getting into them in a professional level? And what drew you into this project and wanting to explore it at the professional level as a historian?
Well, as a kid growing up in Inuvik and at our fish camp, you know, storytelling was a part of our culture. It is a part of our culture. So in many ways, what I've learned about the social world, about who I am, about who my family is, has been through, you know, Gwich'in forms of storytelling. But one of the things that I had found that was largely missing in the story of who I am, of what the North is, of Northern Indigenous peoples, is residential schooling. And when I was a kid growing up, you know, I made observations about folks in our community, about members of our own family who were really suffering. And I had always wondered why. And I never really had a good answer for that until I was in my 20s, decided to go back to university. And this question about residential schools came up. And, you know, my grandmother was institutionalized at Immaculate Conception Indian Residential School in Iqaluit, my mother at Grolier Hall in Inuvik. And so I've come to call myself an intergenerational survivor, but I did not have that knowledge. And this would have been like in the mid 2000s when these conversations were already happening on a national level. I had zero understanding about how that system impacted my own family and my own upbringing and even my own ability to, you know, have on the land skills or to know my language. And so it was in university that I first learned about residential schools. And that's when things, you know, started to make sense a little bit. But my community was largely quiet on the issue. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, other things that we've had to take up, such as questions around self-government, land and resource rights, but additionally, the amount of healing that has had to happen. And so when I became interested in histories of residential schooling professionally, this was around the time of the TRC. And so these conversations and national events were beginning to happen. Folks were getting more comfortable talking about it, but I was also becoming braver to ask the questions sometimes to my own family members. And so that's the context in which this work has grown. And additionally, as I started to settle down myself, as I set out to vision what a career in this field would look like, but also having my own children and asking, you know, what does it mean to be Gwich'in in a world today? What does it mean to raise, you know, a really strong, healthy family with intergenerational trauma? I started to ask different kinds of questions about how survivors experience the institutions themselves, which led to the creation of the book.
I am curious to hear about that silence, though, that you grew up with, that it wasn't something that was talked about that much. It wasn't something that you really knew about until you got into your post-secondary studies. Then how do you go to people as now a professional? Certainly you're a member of the community, but you also have that professional historian. You're going in with that approach for this book. How do you get them to talk to you and to engage in these stories? Because a lot of the book comes out of survivor testimony. So what was that process like for you, going to people, in a lot of cases you know them personally, and trying to build that trust, build the relationship where they're opening up to you about a topic that, as you mentioned, a lot of cases wasn't discussed before?
There for sure has been a lot of ups and downs, I think, over the years. Mm-hmm. And a strength is that I'm engaging with my own community. And so I was so blessed to have many relationships already in place. You know, my grandmother, Marka Bullock, is just a legend in the region. And even today, you know, 10 years after her passing, people will do anything for Marka Bullock and her granddaughter. So I was really lucky in that way that, you know, folks in my community saw a young person who is trying to advance their education and they wanted to help. They did want to. And, you know, at the time, this was 2013, 2014, we did have the TRC, but nobody was really funding work on residential schools. And we know that travel in the north is expensive. So this was me, you know, showing up with no honoraria, with no like professional funds to support this work. I had committed to hiring translators if needed, but, you know, because of residential schools, people were you know, well-versed in English and talked in English. And so I did have quite a few folks who were interested in being interviewed. I also had quite a few folks who said no, you know, they did not want to be interviewed for whatever reason. And I totally respect that. And so when you're in community and also from that community, there's a little bit of this nuanced fine line where, you know, are you showing up as the academic, or are you showing up, you know, as the niece or the neighbor or the friend? And so I've always found that just talking about your work and your intentions and your visit on that particular day with transparency is really helpful, you know. And if I had to go back and do the interviews in a different way, there's not a lot I would change in the sense that, you know, sure, I came with a list of questions, but folks took the interview on themselves. You know, they had shown up. They already knew what they were comfortable sharing. I think today there is more of an atmosphere and maybe an expectation of offering cultural support, of maybe having like an elder or a cultural worker available. And there is also the funding to support that.
And I'm wondering about then editorial control, because I can't think of a better way to say it. But for the survivors, the folks who you're talking to, again, with that fine line of you're a member of the community, you know them, but you're also there as a professional. You know, the reality is, as historians with written documents, we can just sort of use what we want out of them. But these aren't written documents. These are real people and human stories that are still living and that you have relationships with. So what was that process like in terms of deciding what to put in the book explicitly versus not? And did the survivors, did you go back to them afterwards as you were writing to say, hey, I'm going to use this story, I'm not going to use this story? And what was the reaction there?
So for sure, there was a consent process involved in the interviews to begin with. And that was ongoing, you know, like throughout the interview process itself, but also afterwards, had folks who would get in touch with me and say, you know, I know I shared this part of the interview, but, you know, please don't use those words in any published work. And so I would say that it was an ongoing process. And some of those conversations happened in person. Some people did not want to review transcripts. Other people wanted a copy for their records. And so the work itself in the book emerges from the PhD thesis. And so some of the stories I had used for the doctoral work, but then in the book, it's sort of a different thing. And so I chose to maybe include some other stories. I did some new interviews also and used other content. But I think that it's this ongoing process of relationship building, of community work, of, you know, continually asking people what is important to them, because we also know that when I finished the PhD 5 years ago, a lot has happened since then, including the announcement from Tecumloops of 215 possible unmarked graves, to the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, to Kimberly Murray's work and her recent release of the final report for the Special Interlocutor. So I would say that these conversations are ongoing.
And I saw on the news a couple of weeks ago, there's, I believe it's been approved or has funding, or I'm not entirely sure the process of putting together a university, but the Inuit University is coming. They had an event here in Ottawa. So major events, major things are happening across the country in this space. So you're right that something from 5 years ago, it's not that it's out of date, but like it needs to be updated. It needs to continue as these things evolve and continue to change. So I'm curious about the let's get into some of the content in the book, because I could do methodology and this sort of stuff all day, but let's get into some of the content. And the book mentions that there was an increased interest on the part of the federal government in having residential schools and to increase the colonial presence in the North following the Second World War. What was the motivation for the federal government when we get to 1945 to have an increased focus on this region?
Well, I think there were a few different things happening. You know, in the book, I mention that at the end of the Second World War and the trauma and atrocities of the Holocaust, that certain developed countries started to look inwards. And so there was a question of, you know, well, how is Canada treating its Indians, right? And the social policy for Indigenous nations in the North was largely untouched. Many historians have written about the North basically being ignored. And so I think this was a turn in Canadian colonialism, where they decided to concentrate their efforts in a new region to advance, you know, colonialism among Indigenous peoples. I also think that there was a real threat regarding Canadian sovereignty. You had U.S. military workers in the North building roads. You had, you know, weapons testing. You also had things like NORAD and the construction of the Dew Line and questions about Russia's intentions going into the Cold War. And so I think practically there was also this drive to put the settler part in settler colonialism and get a Canadian presence in the Arctic. And that was going to require some development. So those things were happening. But additionally, and this is what is overlooked most of the time, is that Indigenous Northerners themselves had been lobbying and advocating for changes in the North for a long time. Because prior to 1945, there was a well-established network of Indian residential schools. You know, Hay River, Fort Providence, Fort Resolution, the two residential schools in Iqaluit. There was also, for a time, an Eskimo residential school at Shingle Point. And, you know, Indigenous families were tired of having their children relocated thousands of kilometers, sometimes for years and years at a time. And so Indigenous Northerners wanted their children to be educated, but in no way, shape, or form did they ever agree for their child to be removed from their home or institutionalized. And so I think this is also a time period where Indigenous peoples use their ability to lobby, to advocate, to write letters via missionaries, via Indian agents, in order to get some day schools built. What that actually resulted in most of the time was not day schools, but was the sharper focus on the North, in which more residential schools were built.
Is there still, in the early time that you're writing about, is there issues associated with language as part of these discussions? You know, language is used in the home versus language that would be taught in the schools, and an effort on the part of the teachers in the state to get rid of Indigenous languages in the North?
Yeah, well, so yes and no. I mean, yes, in the sense that, like, the official policy at residential schools would be to either speak French or English. At the Oblate run institutions, you know, mass was given in Latin. And so you also have that in the mix. And memories from elders and survivors, you know, in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, do have this focus on the use of violence as a means to eradicate language. Student memories of returning home and not being able to connect with parents or siblings. But there are also occasions, and really depending on where you are, this is what fluctuated. There's this one really great story about a survivor from an Iqaluit residential school, and she says that she actually strengthened her language while institutionalized, because She was used as the interpreter at the residential school and also at the RCMP station there, that like she knew a different dialect of language. But of course, like her story is unique in the sense that like not all children would have been called upon to do that. And also at the end of the day, it was exploitation of child labor.
Sure. Yes. So another thing that the book talks about is the Gwich'in concept of individual and collective strength. That comes up in the book. Before we get into how that manifests itself in the schools themselves with the kids and the families back home, could you just give us a bit of a primer on the Gwich'in concept of individual and collective strength and how that might differ from a colonial framework of those same broad ideas?
So really, the focus on strength actually came from years of my own confusion. And so when I think about residential schools, it did a lot of damage, right? This colonial project, which we now know can be equated to genocide, is really responsible for a lot of trauma in our communities today. And so I've come to understand this story as two things that are very opposite but can be true at the same time. And so our public education, the way we understand the system of residential schooling, is colonialism and genocide, and has resulted in child death, but also in, you know, the loss of our culture and language. On the other hand, the way that survivors talk about their experiences and the way that they kept going at these residential schools, the way that they have come to understand their own healing, is a strength-based approach. And so these two things can be direct opposites, but true at the same time. And I didn't understand this because I was going into this work trying to get answers to questions about my own community, about all of the terrible things that I was seeing. But in survivor interviews, what I was being told was about some of the good times, was about some of the ways that survivors carried on, about how they took up certain activities like sports or like reading or like playing music as a way to cope. And it wasn't until I found these Gwich'in forms of strength with Agnes Mitchell that I was able to make sense of it all. And of course, the other part of this is drawing upon the work of education scholar Eve Tuck. She published an open letter, and she called a moratorium on damage-centered research. Mm-hmm. And so the way that I have read Eve Tuck is this may not actually be an approach for settler scholars. For settler scholars, we still need to understand the archival story. We still need to know how this is genocide, how settler colonialism worked in Canada. But if you're Indigenous and you're working with an Indigenous community, maybe it's time that we turn to a different model. So she says that we need to stop thinking of ourselves as broken if we're going to advance community goals. And this is where Agnes and I came up with the three different forms of strength. One is Vitae, which is like the personal individual strength. The second is Ta'ai, which is ancestral strength, what we get from our relatives. And then the third is Gutai, which is collective strength, the strength that we get from community. And so going forward with acknowledging and also talking about in the book, like all of the bad, horrible stuff that happened, because that is true, but seeking to think about and better understand and honor the experiences of our relatives through this lens of strength that allows us to grow as a community as well.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that with families, because one of the things that I've heard from survivors, I've never done an interview myself, but in listening to interviews or reading transcripts, something that stands out to me when I hear it is that they say that, well, this was just normal for like normal for us, right? Like that this is what we did. This was the life we led, and we this is how we coped with it. They don't, or didn't, in some cases, those who were taken particularly very young, didn't know anything else. It's like, okay, it's time to go to school, and this is what it is. Whereas the family knows back home that this is wrong, or kids who are older who are then taken to these schools, right? They have a context that is different from that. So is there something in those strengths that you identified that resonate or hit differently for the students themselves, the survivors, compared to the trauma imposed on the family? And do they manifest themselves in different ways depending on the situations?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think one of the ways in which I hope this is a new conversation in the book is the role of parents in this story, that they have been largely overlooked as advocates, as caretakers of the people who had to go on when the plane left or the boat left, and they talk about how quiet the communities were. And so I think that, you know, giving them the credit that they deserve for imposing accountability, for showing up at the residential school sometimes to remove their children. They wrote letters to the editor, the local newspaper. They were in constant contact with, you know, their MLA or their elected representative. They used various ways in order to make sure that their kids were still okay, right? However, there is a very sad story there about addiction and about government-operated liquor stores and about social services that are available to parents. On the other hand, you do have some children, and I mean, I have records, the youngest being 10 months old at an Iqaluit residential school. Oh. This is the way that they grew up. This is the way that they knew their life. And this is where, you know, land and region is important, because at Inuvik and Iqaluit, you have some Gwich'in Dene Métis students who are actually privileged because they can go home in summer times. They were sometimes able to go home for Christmas. When the highway was built, the Dempster Highway, that made land and family more accessible for shorter trips, whereas Inuit students from the Eastern Arctic were often stuck for months or years at a time. And so I think that there is some kind of normalization that, you know, this is just my experience, but also the realization that, like, what is happening here is not right. And a part of that actually came through popular culture and media. And so in the words of Sarah Jerome, trying to make us nice white kids, you know, they watch popular television shows during the 60s and 70s. The Dick and Jane stories were taught and read to them. Right. And so these Indigenous children were being indoctrinated with what, like, a normal white family looks like. And then you look at your own situation in the residential school, and that is not it, even if you've lived there your whole life.
Right. Yeah. Fonzie got to go home at the end of the day. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So one of the things the book talks about is the construction of the school in 1959 and how that was a major turning point and flashpoint, really, for residential schooling in the North. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why the school was such an important development and such an important change to residential schooling in the region.
For sure. And so, you know, pre-1959, which is when the institutions opened, Iqaluit was the administrative center for the whole region. This is where the HBC was, the RCMP, that's where the Indian agent lived. But in many ways, Iqaluit was not poised for widespread expansion. For example, you know, with all of these new interventions, they needed a bigger center, in part for the expansion of the military, to construct a new runway for larger aircraft, but also to bring more families in. And Iqaluit is sort of surrounded by river on two sides. And so it does flood every year. That still happens, but not great for the construction of this runway and other expansion. And so this is when they decided that they needed a new administrative center. They located a number of sites. One was called East 3. That is an engineering code, E3, and that later became Inuvik. And so this East 3 later became Inuvik. And so around 1955 is really when they started to build Inuvik. And they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on Inuvik. In many ways, it was talked about and framed as this epicenter of modernity. I think that is an exact quote from an article from a newspaper, the epicenter of modernity. And so Canada had a lot to prove with the construction of Inuvik in the high Arctic. They had a lot of really high expectations. And one was the building of these residential schools of Grolier Hall, which was Oblate run, and Stringer Hall, which was Anglican run. And those meant those were meant to replace the residential schools in Iqaluit. And so the idea was that the whole town of Iqaluit, all of the kids at the Iqaluit residential schools would all relocate to Inuvik, where there would be modern services. They built a brand new hospital, brand new RCMP station, also a brand new scientific research lab. But also Inuvik was designed in a segregated way where, you know, one end of town had no services. It was called Tent Town. There were ramshackle housing. That's where my family lived. And then on the other side was government settler workers who had modern homes with heat and sewage and all that. And so this changed a lot for residential schooling. It started this era of residential schooling during a time when these institutions were closing down south. You know, the residential schooling system was supposed to be winding down. And that was a decision made in 1948, I think, by a special committee struck by the House of Commons. So ongoing project of institutionalizing Indigenous youngsters. But, you know, these institutions of Grolier and Stringer Hall, they were also massive. They each held 250 children. Stringer Hall often ran over capacity. And in many ways, they inherited the same problems as the former residential schools. I mean, not only because it was this ongoing program of residential schooling education, of separating children from their families, of removing us from our lands. But also it was the same staff that came over from Iqaluit. It was the same churches. It was the same oppressive environment. And so while there are many similarities pre-1959 in Iqaluit and post-1959 in Inuvik, there were many things that were the same, but also different. Some of the differences actually come from the state's decision to emphasize the modern aspect. And so these residential schools in Inuvik had plumbing. They were financed in a way that allowed for the hiring of more workers, meaning that the children themselves often were not responsible for the running of the residential school. There was no cleaning out outhouses. There was no children laboring in the kitchen at 4 a.m. So there were differences like that, but really ongoing for the colonialism aspect of the project.
And once the students are in the new school, how does the resistance that you see or that they're expressing, the collective strength that we talked about earlier, how is that expressed? And how are they building that strength, these communities within the schools themselves. Essentially, what is the internal culture that the students develop and build within these new environments?
So, I mean, one other unique aspect of Inuvik that was not seen in Iqaluit is that, yes, you had these students institutionalized at Grolier Hall and Stringer Hall, but they did leave every day and they went to a day school with all of the other children who lived in town, some Indigenous, some settler. And so in a way, that experience of being able to physically leave the residential school and go somewhere else, that was a good thing. They were also at the day school, which was Sir Alexander Mackenzie's school. I went to that school myself. It was still running in the 80s. That day school was also responsible to settler parents, which means that children from RCMP, military, government workers, missionaries, like all of the kids went to the day school. And settler parents required a standard in order to live there. And so, I mean, was there racism at that school? Absolutely. But were there ways in which the kids were being educated in a different way? That is true. There was more available to them. There were things like student council that they could join. There was organized sports in very new and different ways. There were other opportunities such as reading club, learning how to play chess, other kinds of things that they learned, like not only in your structured day of the school, but also in extracurricular activities that would have added to their experience. It would have exposed them to more things. And I mean, in the realm of sports, you know, I also just published a podcast called How I Survived, which talks about sport and recreation at residential schools in the North. And we have an interview from survivor Sharon Firth. Sharon was institutionalized in Inuvik, and she also attended day school. She is a four-time Olympian for cross-country skiing. And so these kids found things that they were able to latch onto and used to thrive. And, you know, one thing Sharon talks about is how running her family's trap line actually gave her the conditioning to be an excellent international cross-country skier. So these kids already had strength. They already had experience. They were just trying to figure out how to use it in a way that felt really good. And so sometimes that happened, sometimes it did not happen.
The book gets into the 1980s and the shutdown, the slowdown of the residential school system. What was the process? What was that process like in the North? And was it distinct from the residential schools we see elsewhere across Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we know that the residential school system did not actually close in Canada until 1996, which has really escaped the attention of many historians. You know, you read some of these classic Canadian history books and it leads you to believe that, you know, most institutions were closed in the 70s, but we know that's not the case. And we also know that one of the reasons that facilitated the closure of residential schools was not turning towards a project to allow Indigenous children to learn their own traditions, but actually that the rate of day schooling was advancing at a pace where children could stay in their own communities and go to the Indian day school. So were these better conditions? For sure. You're in your own community, going home every night on your own lands. We do know that Indian day schooling was also awful and traumatic. But the fact that those were opening, again, to the credit of many parents and communities who were demanding them because they didn't want their child gone for 10 months a year, that activism, that holding government accountable, constructing those actual schools themselves meant that the residential schools weren't being filled. They weren't meeting their attendance quotas. The churches were not profiting from them like they used to because the funding was allocated on a student-by-student basis, that eventually there was no longer reason to run these very expensive institutions, that they were able to impart colonial education at the community level.
What legacy is there? And this is a huge question that you could do a full hour on, but what is the legacy of the schooling system in the North for the people who are there? We talked earlier about intergenerational trauma, the impact there, but is there a real legacy of it? And how do you, and I know this is always dangerous to ask of historians, how do you forecast moving forward the continued legacy and how individuals there, like yourself, who are members of the community, but not necessarily there physically all the time, how is that going to continue to manifest as we process what the system was and continue to deal with its ramifications?
Well, you know, I think particularly in the North, this is all still very fresh. You know, 1996 is not that long ago. I myself lived across the street from the notorious Grolier Hall. So the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission called Grolier Hall one of the most notorious institutions in Canada. We know that for 30 years straight, there was not one year that a predator was not employed at Grolier Hall. Some reports have suggested upwards of 80% of students were sexually abused. And so this is still very fresh. Not everybody is in the same place regarding their healing. And we're also trying to do this among other devastating conditions, such as inadequate housing, ongoing land claim and self-government operations, food insecurities. And so it is difficult. And additionally, in the Northwest Territories specifically, about half the population is Indigenous. And so we actually have a concentration of survivors unlike anywhere else in Canada. We're often forgotten in the North. I was just talking to someone this morning who reminded me about the big federal class action lawsuit on child welfare that did not pass recently. But the North was excluded from that entirely. And so I think a part of the process will be continuing to chart the path forward in ways that feel good for our communities and for our nations, to advance healing, to encourage our neighbors and allies to keep on truth and reconciliation, never forget the truth part. We're still looking for that. And to just empower and uphold our own people and to try and undo residential schools that is still very much an issue, and that will look different for every community, whether we focus on language, whether we focus on the land programs, whether we develop a relationship with a researcher or a university. So I really look forward to watching these things unfold and maybe being a part of the conversation.
And the book really fits into all that, and it's a very important and very good contribution. So again, it's By Strength, We Are Still Here, Indigenous Peoples and Residential Schooling in Inuvik Northwest Territories. Crystal, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or keep track of all the other work you have going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
For sure. So the book itself is available through the University of Manitoba Press. It is also on Amazon. From what I've been told, Indigo has ordered copies, but you can also find me at crystalfraser.com.
And we will link to all that down in the show notes below. I encourage you all to check it out. Crystal Gale Fraser, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate the interest.
So there you have it, my chat with Crystal Gale Fraser, and I thank her for her time. And again, the book is By Strength, We Are Still Here, Indigenous Peoples and Indian Residential Schooling in Inuvik, Northwest Territories. And with that, let's get to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the CBC, Jennifer Dulwich, from May 2024. Long overdue, Inuvik Northwest Territories looks to rename street that commemorates residential school priests. And in this article, it talks about a committee decision to rename Runyant Crescent, which is a short residential loop in the town's west end, which was named after Father Max Runyon, a Catholic priest who ran Grolier Hall for more than 20 years. One of the suggested new names for the street was Jack Z Place, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The name means blueberry in Gwich'in, and it was proposed after the committee listened to stories of individuals in the region. So the article talks to some folks in the community, and the people who are interviewed are pretty unanimous in their support for this, that Max Runyon was not somebody who they would want to continue to commemorate in this way in the town. And given the importance of the local blueberry patch, a fitting change and a fitting way to have the street better reflect the local community. And it speaks to what Crystal and I were talking about towards the end of our conversation about the lasting legacy and the continued processing of what happened at the residential school. And this is one example of that. And on this show in the past, I've made the point that I don't really like naming things after people in any capacity. And here's another example of why. And certainly this individual, given everything that happened at that school and what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation have identified in their research as to what happened in the school, not something that you want to celebrate in the community. Of course, something that it is important to remember and to know what happened. As the Truth and Reconciliation Commission said, truth is an important part of that. So it's not a matter of hiding or forgetting what happened, but not honoring an individual who is part of that system. So this is a change that was recommended, and it's part of the ongoing process of reconciliation in Inuvik, and we're seeing it in communities all across the country. And just as Crystal said, that it's an ongoing process and moving forward, her and other members of the community will continue to have these types of discussions and address what happened at the residential schools. So an interesting note that comes out of the community certainly is relevant to the book and the continued legacy of what happened there in Inuvik. So today's historical headline of the week from May 7, 2024 by Jenna Dulwich. Long overdue, Inuvik Northwest Territories looks to rename street that commemorates residential school priests. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. You want to let me know what you want to hear on the show? whatsoldestnews@gmail.com. And of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab. And next Friday, the 20th of December, Aaron Boyes and I are going to be back with our annual Year in Review 100 Years Later, where we will go back and look at all the biggest events of 1924. Do it in a bracket format to determine the most important event of the year. We've been doing this for about 10 years now. I think all the past ones are linked in each one we do. But one of our favorite things that we do over the course of the year is to look back from 100 years ago. So that'll be up on the site on December the 20th, along with all the other great written material. So I encourage you to check it out. And as for the podcast, we'll be back with a best of 2024 next week. And then a couple of my favorite ones from the History Slam will go out over the holidays. And we'll be back with a new episode for you that first week of January. But do keep an eye on the feed for episodes in between now and then. As I said, next week, a best of 2024 and a couple of my favorite conversations from the History Slam on the weeks of December 23rd and 30th. And we'll be back with some new stuff the week of January the 6th when we join you for more What's Old is News.